everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in to our next episode of Three Professors Walk Into a Bar. This is our third episode focusing on migration and climate change. We've got a group of phenomenal professors with us today, which I'm going to have them introduce themselves here real quick, just so we know who's talking, and then we'll jump straight into conversation. So if you wouldn't mind starting, just say your name and what you do here.
Sure. First off, thanks for having us. My name is Ali Arab, and I'm a professor at the Mathematics and Statistics Department. I'm a statistician. I work on environmental and ecological models, a lot of times with an eye on effects of climate change or interactions with climate change. I'm also a member of the board of Amnesty International USA. Just to clarify, I'm not here representing Amnesty International, so I'm not serving in that capacity, but I will talk about Amnesty International's work in that case.
Great. Hi, everybody. My name is Beth Ferris. I'm a research professor at the Institute for the Study of International Migration, and I teach courses on refugees, migration, and particularly interested in the relationship between climate change, disasters, environmental change, and the movement of people. Yeah. And I'm really glad that you're focusing on this issue. It's very, very important, and it's great to know that students are engaged with this.
Absolutely. We got 102 very engaged with it.
All right.
I'm Neely Yosinger. I'm a researcher with the Institute for the Study of International Migration and also with the Senior Vice President for Research here at Georgetown. And most of the work that I do focuses on the impact that protracted crises have, so crises that have been at least 5 years or so, the impact that that has on the local environment that's hosting refugees. Thank you for having us here.
Of course. All right. Well, so we got talking a little bit before here and just trying to see what a good angle to bring all these incredible different professors and faculty together to get a really meaningful conversation out of here. And the first topic that came up has got to be hurricanes. It's just they're are more frequent and more common, and because of rising tides and things like that, have had some more severe impacts as well. So I want to kind of leave it at that and see what your guys' take is on this most recent hurricane season. Maybe we can focus maybe on Puerto Rico or something like that, or maybe Houston, just to look at an example. But just want to leave it there, see what you guys think. I'd love to hear your expert opinion on it.
You know, some years ago, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which brings together researchers all over the world, looked at the relationship between these extreme weather events and climate change, saying that you can never say that any one hurricane is due to climate change. And I'm sure, Ali, you can talk more about some of the difficulties with correlation, causation. But the trend seems to be that weather-related disasters are becoming more frequent, unpredictable, intense. There is a relationship, but it's not necessarily a causal one. Yeah. And it's interesting to talk to people in the field and see how they draw those relationships. I was just in coastal Louisiana last week looking at communities that are affected by coastal erosion, subsidence, and so on. And, you know, a lot of them don't see any connection with climate change. We've always had hurricanes. There's always been environmental change, while others, you know, point the finger directly because of the warming temperatures in the world. We're going to see more of this, and we may be forced with leaving our land. But maybe, Ali, you ought to tell us about, you know, how we can draw this relationship between.
Sure. So that's actually a great segue to what I wanted to talk about, which is the idea of, climate change is as a global constant change is not really accurate, but rather, you know, change in the climate is happening with spatial nuances. In certain areas, we're seeing more droughts, more severe droughts, more frequent droughts. In certain areas, we see more flooding events. And so, as you mentioned, Beth, it's true that the frequency and the intensity of these events are increasing. And over long periods of time, that's where we can actually study these kind of patterns and changes in short-term periods, which is usually what people's memories refer to. That, you know, as far as I remember, we always had hurricanes. Well, but, you know, if you study that over longer periods of time, that's where you realize that these changes are actually happening.
Yeah. So long-term period of time means a lot to a lot of different fields. So what does long-term mean here? Is it 100 years, is it a lifetime, is it two, three?
So, you know, have you seen that hockey stick mm-hmm. plot Longer. Of the, yeah, yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. So the plot of the global temperature increase over time. And that's a global average. So just going back to what I was just talking about, a lot of these nuances will be kind of smoothed out. But still, when you look at thousands of years, you see that incredible change over the past 100 years or so.
Yeah.
Now, do we have temperature readings going back, you know, 3,000 years ago? We don't have direct measures. We probably have direct measures only for 100, 150 years. But what we have is we have ice cores and these other measure ways that we can actually measure temperature, for example.
I think oftentimes when people think of disasters in relation to climate change, they point to the things that are most prevalent, like hurricanes, right? I mean, it's just such a big storm that comes out and everybody's like, there's a hurricane, there's a hurricane, there's a hurricane. I think droughts and water management in this context is an interesting thing to look at as well. And we hit on that just really briefly here. So I'd love to dive into that a little bit more, and especially as that pertains to sort of long-term instability in regions and how that pertains to how whole societies kind of reshape around that, especially areas that are prone to droughts. Might be just an interesting point to dive into.
Yeah. So I guess just to give a little bit of context on the study that I was referencing earlier, the project that we were doing was tasked with looking specifically at the way the environment is impacted by refugees that are long-term in a host country. The other thing that we were tasked with doing was looking specifically at arid climates. This is a traditionally understudied part of looking at migration and environmental change. But also, there was a bit of a perception that the impact in an arid climate would be significantly worse than it would be in any other kind of climate. So we specifically chose Ethiopia and Djibouti. One, because they're arid climates, they both fall close to or below the international water poverty line. They're both have camps in rural communities. And also importantly, the local population is about 3,000 in each, but the population of the camp is about 12,000. So for Ethiopia, who's been hosting for about 12 years now in that particular camp, and Djibouti has been hosting refugees in that area for about 25 years. What's interesting with regard to water is that our study found that there was actually very little negative impact that came directly from the camp's presence. But what was impacted was the way water resources are managed. They have very little to begin with. And then when you talk about having to share the little that they have with a larger population, and that's, we're not just talking about people, we're also talking about the livestock and other activities, growing vegetables in the desert. I mean, these are all things that require better water management, and that's a real gap for the camps. Some of those gaps are physical, but some of them are also just political. You know, the camps that have refugees for this long a period of time, they don't necessarily want that population to grow. And so to some, it seems like if you put an extra borehole or a few more water pumps in the camp, you're kind of encouraging people to congregate there. And that's been a real issue.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at the relationship between refugees and climate or environmental issues. Yeah. You know, this is how I got started in the field. I was worked with refugees and displaced people displaced by conflict all my life. Yeah. And after the tsunami in 2004 in South Asia, and then the next year Hurricane Katrina, mm-hmm. I started thinking, I'm hearing the same things from people displaced by these storms that I hear from people displaced by war.
Yeah.
A feeling of having lost family members, of possessions, of starting all over, but also feelings of being abandoned by their government, forgotten. I mean, really heart-wrenching stories from people displaced by Katrina living in Houston that sounded like South Sudan.
Yeah.
You know, and looking at some of the common experiences that humans face when they're forced to leave was what really drew me into this field.
Yeah.
Sure. So that kind of reminds me of this whole notion of human rights, which, you know, we seem to have this perception that human rights is always a political or free speech issue. But actually, you know, it's the right to life, the right to water, the right to food, the right to health, the right to housing, all of these other rights that are affected by climate change. And that's really the connection to me, between climate change and human rights issues. Yeah. So it's multifaceted in that sense, yeah. And so that makes it very difficult and challenging to deal with. Actually.
Yeah. I think trying to loop back. So we're talking about migration as the topic of what we're talking about today, and I think this was a excellent framing about how, I mean, just changing circumstances make it so that different places have to reframe their water management or are displaced just by storms and houses being lost, and it's sort of like an infrastructure level as well, a number of different ways. I think one of these sort of interesting questions here is, you often hear climate change is typically disproportionately affecting those who can't afford to move, or for those who are have less means to be able to adapt to that. So how does that migration from the perspective of being able to respond to something like climate change, and being able to have, like, what are the options there, and how does that sort of play out on a larger scale for situations like refugee camps? I mean, refugee camps can't really up and move, right? I mean, that's not a simple thing to displace 12,000 people and more than that as well. So I think that's an interesting nugget to kind of look at here and what that looks like.
In fact, that was one of our key recommendations coming out of this project, was the idea that refugees should be allowed to go in search of better climate conditions, in search of, you know, better opportunities to grow. A lot of the population that we looked at had a nomadic lifestyle before they became refugees. So living in a camp is not only, you know, taking away from the lifestyle that they're used to, but it's also very hard to have any kind of, to feel like you have a stake or to care necessarily about the environment and whether or not you're impacting it when you have no say in what happens or where you go. And then, you know, there's a double-edged sword to where these refugees have been placed too. On one hand, they're placed in areas where that, you know, have no resources and have, you know, very limited, you know, opportunities. On the other hand, they're placed there because they don't necessarily want to encourage refugees to come and stay for a long time. Yeah. So it's poorly placed in terms of resources, which not only affects them, but also affects the local population, who often don't have a say in where these camps go. Yeah. But then they put them there for a reason as well, and that reason is more political. Yeah. So.
But I think it's fair to say that climate change disasters, you know, has differential impacts on different parts of the population.
Yeah.
You know, Hurricane Harvey destroyed homes of rich people and poor people, but now their situations are quite different. Their access to money to rebuild, even their possibilities of evacuation. You know, people who don't have much money can't afford to go stay in a hotel for a few days and know what happens. And you know, I think we have to recognize that, you know, it's always the case that these things tend to hit the poorest sectors of the population the worst.
And, absolutely.
You see that too with these slow onset disasters. I've done a lot of work in the Pacific, and you see Pacific islands where they see the writing on the wall, the water is rising, their fresh water supply is being compromised, and people with means are getting out.
Yeah.
People who can afford to send their kids to school in Australia will say, get a good education and maybe you can stay there.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of raises the specter of who's going to be left behind and what will happen to them.
Yeah. I think a lot of how we try to frame these is trying to get this really meaningful, rich conversation, which we have just gotten, and thinking about now, just from all of your experiences, climate change is such a hard thing to grapple with, and thinking about proactively, like, what can people be doing about this? And you guys have this phenomenal global experience, and climate change really is just a global experience. I mean, what can be done here, and what are the next steps here? I mean, your research is incredibly compelling right on this, because you provide recommendations for what to do next. But I think it'd be just interesting to hear where there's room to get involved, where there's room to do something to act on this in some way.
If you talk to people in the affected areas, they would be begging Americans and Chinese and others to stop your emissions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stop the causes that are making the climate unbearable for different parts of the world. I think there's been a real sea change in looking at migration and climate change in the last 6 or 7 years, from seeing migration as really a terrible consequence to seeing it as a form of adaptation.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a way of adapting to a changing environment, is to move to someplace safer. Migration isn't always bad. Migration shouldn't always be prevented. You know, it can be a very helpful way for families to cope with, a degraded environment, at least partially, apparently caused. You can correct me, Ali. Yeah, by climate change.
Yeah, we got to be careful with that word.
I know.
I think it probably also matters whether or not you're forced into a particular location or a particular environment situation versus being able to go where the resources are.
Yeah, and to clarify, a lot of these migrations that are induced by climate change, mm-hmm. For example, that refugee crises that currently we're facing or over the past couple of years we were facing, they may not be necessarily directly affected by climate change, but rather through climate change affects social and economic structure.
Yeah.
And then once there's a conflict or actually those affected social and economic structures will actually tend to create conflicts. Mm-hmm. And then you get these refugee and migration basically processes started.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the migration that is kind of affected and motivated or in a way initiated by changes in the climate, a lot of times are very local, are mostly internal displacements as opposed to migrations. So it's the migration from the areas that by the sea, and the sea level is rising, or there's a flooding event, so there's migration towards inland areas, that sort of thing. So preparedness at those areas that are vulnerable to changes in the climate is very important. In Washington, D.C., for example, mm-hmm. is now Washington, D.C. is considering thinking about the ways that we can adapt and we can become more resilient to climate change.
Yeah.
So that preparedness, I think, is very important.
Yeah.
But I'm a political scientist, so I see politics everywhere.
Yeah.
But one of the difficulties is that for politicians to be able to respond well to a sudden onset disaster is really important.
Yeah.
If you fail to respond, you pay a political price sometimes. But for these long-term trends, when you may take measures now that will only see the benefit in 10 or 20 years, there's no political payoff.
Yeah.
Why should I take measures to prevent coastal erosion 10 years from now when I won't be in power anymore?
Yeah.
See what I mean? There's this political dynamic of, needing to have the short-term political payoffs, and yet the long-term consequences, you don't have that. And so results are more likely to be catastrophic.
Yeah. I think we've heard that a couple points here now of like referring back to sort of like how this is a political issue in a lot of ways and how how does that sort of resilience get built in when it's hard to get stakeholder buy-in because, you're preparing for, you're asking people to pay for something that's 20 years off or 15 years off. And no matter how much the modeling suggests, yes, this is going to happen in 20 years, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. How do you help foster, how do you navigate that sort of stakeholder buy-in and political buy-in to do something like that?
I'm not sure if this directly relates to what you just asked, but I wanted to just point out for a second that in a dream world, at least with the long-term displacement crises, you would want to be able to put in place mechanisms for preventing environmental degradation versus having to respond and fix it or clean it later.
Yeah.
The problem, of course, is that there's always a new crisis, and it's very easy to forget the ones that never went away.
Yeah.
If you look at the news today, you have a situation in Myanmar and Bangladesh, you have a situation in Syria, but, the situation in Somalia never got better. The situation in Sudan is just as bad as it was. But these are not things that you necessarily hear about.
Yeah.
The problem for preparing for these is that you don't always know how long a crisis is going to last.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to convince, a humanitarian response organization with very few resources to say, hey, before you put this camp up, you should do an environmental impact assessment to make sure that you're putting it in a place that, is viable, that's going to be sustainable long term. You don't know if it's going to be long term. So one of the things that they've been talking about a lot in terms of environmental impact, we're trying to develop a better relationship between long-term development organizations and humanitarian response organizations. how can we develop an environmental impact assessment that's very, very fast, that we can put in place to help us decide where to place something when you don't necessarily know how long it's going to be there. But it's really hard to convince people that this is just as important as responding to immediate needs like shelter and food and water when you have so many crises and new ones developing all the time. So
I think education and climate change is very important, you know, that, you know, so it's, this is not a scientific idea that only we talk about it in scientific, you know, conferences. This is something that will affect us all. Yeah. This is the air that we all breathe, and this is the water that we all drink. And it's a global issue, so no matter where in the world you are, you'll be affected by it, you know, at some level or another. Yeah. And so, you know, the issue of political you know, accountability actually is an important one that Beth brought up. So, you know, the Paris Climate Summit 2 years ago, you know, they decided a shift of to 100% renewable energy by 2050. That is a long time beyond most politicians, current politicians' careers.
Yeah.
And so holding them accountable at that level may not be an easy thing.
Yeah.
So with targets that are closer in time to us, maybe we can actually set better tone for the politicians to act upon these things.
But Ali, I mean, I think that the impetus has to come from the people, from the population, that this education, this political pressure to do something. You know, we've seen some of that in the U.S. With a, you know, a lot more uptake on things like recycling. You know, the 20 years ago wasn't a big deal, and people want it. You know, they understand the relationship.
Yeah.
So I think that pressure needs to be there from the base, so that politicians will make the right decisions.
Especially now that we have basically, you know, some of the most powerful countries in the world, some of the biggest economies in the world, are either not acting on climate change, or some of them simply are denying climate change.
Oh, would you have a particular opinion?
Well,
<you
know. laughs> so you know, that makes it difficult, you know, and so that's the challenge these days. That, and so I totally agree with your idea that, you know, it has to be from bottoms up, because, you know, the top-down approach, first off, it's not effective all the time, and simply it's just not going to happen in you know, the days that we're facing right now. And so, you know, that's understanding knowledge at that level is important, and being engaged and being proactive at that level. You know, it's important that you recycle at your home, but it's also important that you think that by recycling, you didn't do your fair share of caring about climate. There's more to that. And you have to engage more in the community level and nonprofit organizational levels, just because there's a dire need, especially nowadays, because we don't have the backing of the government in many cases. And so we're basically on our own with our nonprofit entities to fight for many of these things.
So you have 102 students right now who are all rearing to go on this. excited Georgetown students who have chosen to focus on climate change for their core curriculum for an entire year. It's a pretty special group, and a group that is in five different disciplines, right? Theology, philosophy, history, sciences, and also in literature and environmental crisis as well. How do we engage this group in a way? I mean, it's such a, it's a hyper-focused thing, but we've got tangible people who want to do something. And oftentimes, I think the biggest thing is just knowing where to start. I mean, a lot of people grab onto recycling and their own lifestyle, because, and oftentimes that's effective, but it's really not enough in a lot of instances, but it's what they can grab onto. It's what they know. I think a lot, especially lately, right? I mean, with, like you're saying, if there's not that top-down support, a lot of times people kind of feel lost and don't really know where that first step is to actually engage with it. And I imagine we're all figuring that out a little bit right now as we go. But I mean, anything that you guys might have to kind of like speak on that, 102 people, I think would love to love to hear your thoughts on that. I mean, just how to get that first step in, I think sort of building that.
Well, my advice for your 102 students is, you know, be aware this is complex. You know, I would say be suspicious of simple answers. If it's like peeling an onion. You see climate change is related to this and that. It isn't just climate change, but it's also our patterns of human settlements. Yeah. You know, sea level rises, and it is rising. Yeah. It affects cities, but the fact that there are more cities on the coast and more people living in marginal situations makes it all more risky. Yeah. So I think just kind of understanding the complexity of it is a really good first step. Yeah. And then seeing the connections between our life here at Georgetown and what's happening nationally and regionally and internationally is maybe the next step. I don't think, I think recycling is great, but it isn't going to be enough. It isn't going to be enough. I think it's going to mean major lifestyle changes, like our dependence on cars and fossil fuels, and are you willing to give up air conditioning? Yeah. Well, I'm not sure in Washington in August, but but you know, I think there are going to be some tough trade-offs if we're really going to turn this thing around.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, so, and, you know, another aspect is that, you know, these students, these 102 students are
engaged students
yeah. are going
most
to
most aren't, right?
No. Yes, are the futures of this country. There's a sample of people who are futures of this world, right? And so we our generations have started movements, and you guys have to continue this. And, you know, keep in mind that it's an essential part of, I mean, we've gone through a cultural shift that now recycling is the norm. You know, I still see many places, many people that don't do it, but you know, it has become the norm. People have, you know, come to understanding that it's important to, for example, recycle. We need to generate and create similar type of understanding about other aspects of related to climate change, other aspects of energy, for example, you know, that fossil fuels are just not sustainable. If we want to depend on fossil fuels, we're doomed, basically. and so, you know, and think about how you can actually use your qualities and become entrepreneurs that are trying to improve your own life as life of others through ways that you can actually tackle issues in climate change, for example. You know, renewable energy is a new way of doing business. A lot of businesses are now in that working in that area. So, you know, those kind of future endeavors are very important. And also understand that this is a complex problem, as Beth was talking about, that you're going to be part of a process, a challenging process. And so all of these expertise that you just listed and more are needed. You know, it's not something that one person or one type of discipline can tackle.
And I'd encourage your 102 engaged students to think about running for office and think about going to meetings with your representatives and asking questions about climate change. People, that's what people respond to, politicians.
I was just going to say the reality of the situation being that there are full populations that are going to need to relocate. Yeah. There are always going to be host communities. Do everything you can to support the host communities is really what it comes down to.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so just to follow up to the point that, you know, Beth mentioned, you know, with being suspicious of simple answers, I want to add also a statistical spin to that and say, be suspicious of anecdotal evidence. You know, if somebody brought you a snowball and said, you know, there's no global warming, you know, be suspicious of that. We're looking at statistical trends here.
I think that's really important. Yeah. And it's important to point that out every time you speak. Yeah, it isn't just one particular event.
I think that's a good place to move to here is I mean, we talked a lot about, I mean, you mentioned how there are so many things going on that you lose track of things that have happened for a long period of time already. Those things disappear off the map and you get oversaturated with information and people bring snowballs into Congress and I mean, things like that, right? I mean, how do you sift through? Because we live in a world where there's so much information. How do you get to what's actually valuable and thinking about that? I mean, that's an important note, and just kind of what that looks like as you're moving forward.
So be meticulous in understanding what's the source of the information. You know, I mean, nowadays we're living in a time that information is flowing constantly, and you know, the rate of information that is thrown at us through social media is just so high that it's hard to keep up with fact checking. And unfortunately, you know, that fact checking is not happening. And you know, as students of Georgetown, as students, you should create, and you should have this capability to question, you know, these sources, and ask for credibility of the sources. Make sure that the underlying information is coming from scientific endeavor. You know, it's not just somebody putting out there an opinion, but rather there is evidence, and you know, it's a fact-based argument.
I'm often inspired or depressed by the actual lived experience of particular communities. You know, the communities in Alaska where there isn't any political question. They have to move. The permafrost is melting, the temperatures, the coastal erosion. You know, you talk to them, you read about them. You know, it's real. You can't deny it. I mean, everybody from Sarah Palin to the Corps of Engineers, everybody agrees these communities have to move because of the effects of climate change. And, you know, hearing some of those firsthand experiences, while perhaps anecdotal, also give you a sense of the real human dimensions of this.
I mean, I think that's a powerful component too. I mean, part of what how we started this whole semester with our students is we gave them a prompt of, you're going home for Thanksgiving, and you have to talk to your uncle who knows about climate change but doesn't buy it. How do you have that conversation? And a lot of times people have seen the statistics and the data behind it, and they're like, well, I don't know about that, and make up their own opinion, which you're welcome to. And then the anecdotal thing is another component. I mean, that discussion, I think, is crucial. And I mean, it's a question we've been wrestling with this whole semester, is how to talk about this in a way. I mean, so the insight on that as well would be great. I mean, the anecdotal piece.
This is the first time I've been to coastal Louisiana last week in some of these communities. And these were all Trump supporters. They all have guns. Liberal is a very, very bad word. And yet they're seeing the evidence of their land disappearing. And the reality is that people who've lived for generations in these areas are going to have to move. And it was heartbreaking, and didn't have anything to do about politics, unusually for me, but it didn't. but it did have to do with their lived. They could see it, you know. They could say things like, you know, when my granddad was here, the water was out there, and now it's up to our porch.
All right, so we have time for a couple more questions here. Just want to make sure we get you all out on time.
Nice and smart.
Yeah, no, absolutely. but I'd really love to kind of open it up here just to see if there's anything that we missed that you'd feel bad not mentioning, or something you'd like to bring up here. We've talked from a whole range of different things, from storms and to refugee crises, and into fact checking and everything in between. So I mean, I'd love to see if there's anything else we kind of left off the table here that you'd want to bring up.
I think it might be interesting to talk about the words we use. You know, sometimes you hear climate change refugee. The term refugee in international law has a very specific meaning. It means somebody who's crossed a border. And as I think you pointed out, Ali, most people who are displaced by environmental reasons are within the borders of their country. You know, so I think the term climate change refugee isn't the right term, but we don't have many good alternatives. You know, environmentally induced migrant doesn't have the same ring as refugee, and so I think we're all grasping for the right terms. So. And also, you know, even though most people displaced by disasters and climate change will be within the borders of their country, some will have to leave their country. And our legal system is totally inadequate. There is no category of environmental migrant. You're presumed to be coming voluntarily. You know, we saw some pretty bad policies after some disasters, such as Haiti, which was an earthquake, not related to climate change, but, you know, people fleeing devastation caused by an earthquake were turned away. You know, you're sorry, you know. So I think we're going to have to adapt our legal system somehow to deal with this phenomenon.
I think looking at long-term crises, too, I think there's a big sustainability question. You have populations such as the Horn of Africa, ones that I mentioned, They're not going to go away. They're probably going to remain there. They can't go home. Yeah. They're not going to be resettled to a third country. That's their home. Yeah. And figuring out a way to get them to see that home as their own, get the local communities to accept that as being their home. There's also a question of those populations continuing to grow. You've seen a lot more of flooding and drought in the Horn of Africa, and so you're probably going to see, you know, many more people coming into these camps. So looking forward, how can you make those camps sustainable? Obviously, one of the options that we've thrown out there is don't make them live in camps, allow them to move around. But looking even at the camps themselves, making sure that what you provide to the refugees in the camp is equitable and is available to the local communities, and that starts very much with water. The water borehole that was built in the camp outside in Ethiopia was built intentionally outside the front door so that the local community could use it. When you build a school, you should allow the local community to take, you know, take part in the classes. If you build a healthcare center, you should let the local community use it. Doing these kinds of things will make better relationships across the two communities, will be more sustainable, and might help you be better prepared for people who might end up having to come in because of environmental change and weather events. So
I want to take a moment and challenge your listeners to think for a second that, you know, migration is not something that will affect others. It may actually affect you too. So and it's a difficult process. You know, I'm an immigrant myself, so I've experienced that firsthand. Now, I was born, raised in Iran. I did my undergraduate studies in Iran. Yeah. I came to U.S. for graduate work and basically for better living. Mm-hmm. So I was not really forced to leave my home country, but although I can argue that there were elements that made it unfavorable for me to stay in the country that I was born in. So that process is not easy. And so that understanding at the individual level that, you know, migration process, whether it's force or, you know, by climate, force or by political reasons, is not an easy process. And unfortunately, we're living in a time that government support are lacking in this process. When the U.S. Has just recently reduced the cap on the number of refugees that we're accepting, it is all-time low going back to a couple decades. And so with that understanding, I want to also encourage you to engage in the political process. You know, as students, as citizens, engage in the political process, whether it's your local area, whether you want to, next time you hear news and moves you, make a phone call, send an email to your representative, to your senator. You know, this is, you know, sign a petition. These are things that will make a difference. You may not consider that signing a petition will make differences, but when it's millions of people doing that, it will move mountains.
Absolutely. I think that's a great place to end right there. I just wanted to say thank you all so much for joining us today on the episode, third episode, Three Professors Walk Into a Bar. Just a phenomenal group. We've been sitting in the sciences a little bit for our first two episodes, and we're starting to move into these more broader concepts.
More interesting
things, right? Yeah. So thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thanks.